Good afternoon and welcome to the Colorado Court of Appeals. Counsel are willing to set up while I make the brief preliminary announcements. We have experienced counsel here. Have both of you read our written procedures? Do you have any questions?
None, Your Honor.
Respect to the people in the gallery, if any of you has a cell phone, pager, or similar device, would you please turn it off so that the lawyers are not interrupted? We have three arguments scheduled today. After the first case, we will take a short recess and reconfigure the court. Otherwise, we're ready to proceed with People versus Peoples.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, my name is Danielle Joffe, J-O-F-F-E, appearing on behalf of defendant appellant, Mr. Peoples. I would ask some leave from the court. I have a really bad head cold today, and so if you have a question and it takes me a second or two to try and figure out what the hell I'm trying to say, I would appreciate fundamentally, this is not a case involving whether my client is guilty or innocent. There are all sorts of facts that, at least on the surface, appear to be very detrimental towards my client's claim. However, my client's claim is based on the strict enforcement of the Uniform Mandatory Disposition of Detainers Act, which is a state act that was in effect at the time my client was arrested, charged, tried, and convicted of the underlying offenses. I've laid out most of my arguments in my brief. One of the points that I think is most important is that, unlike the general speedy trial statute, under the UMDDA, harm to my client is irrelevant, and frankly, my client's actions are irrelevant. My client filed several claims, none of which were accepted by the court until the claim he filed in, I believe it was May of 2002. Excuse me. The district court accepted that filing date as the date my client invoked his rights under the UMDDA. Under the UMDDA, prior to 1995, a defendant could implicitly waive his rights under the UMDDA. However, in 1995, the legislature presumably understood the implications of how the courts were interpreting it, and they added a subsection 2. And in subsection 2, it became necessary for a defendant to waive his total rights under the UMDDA to knowingly expressly waive those rights, and the expression expressly waiving rights is a term of art used in the courts and presumably intended and applied by the legislature. An express waiver is the same sort of waiver that one must engage in before waiving constitutional rights. So I believe the legislative record is clear that, unlike any other speedy trial provision, the UMDDA requires an express waiver. And in order to have an express waiver, there has to be an express advisement by the trial court. In this case, on July 8th of that year, my client, unbeknownst to the court, was having severe medical problems, since documented in the record. And he agreed to a waiver of his UMDDA rights. In those days, the UMDDA deadline was 90 days. But what he agreed to in waiving his UMDDA rights was simply to waive his UMDDA rights as to having a trial within 90 days of the May deadline. At no point did the court ever expressly tell him or expressly advise him or ensure that he understood that by making his request for continuance in July, he would be giving up his rights under the UMDDA in total.
Well, do we have to, and I'll go slow because you said you might have a hard time hearing this. Do we have to deal with this on the basis of having forever waived his UMDD rights? Wouldn't an alternative be to hold the defendant accountable for the period of time lost due to this continuance, and then ask the question whether he was brought to trial within whatever was left of the 90 days at the time he requested the continuance?
I agree with the court completely.
Okay, well, wasn't he brought to trial within the remaining 37 days?
No, he was not.
Can you tell, walk the dates through with me, or the timeline,
he,
please.
The interpretation that I chose to argue is that by waiving his rights, he had to be brought to trial within 90 days of the date of waiver. So on July 8th, when he waived his rights under the UMDDA, he was obligated by the state, because the burden is on the state and the courts, not on the defendant, to bring him to trial within 90 days. He,
okay, but 90 days of when?
90 days of July 8th, the day that he asked for a continuance.
But why does that date control the 90 days?
Well, frankly, I was taking a liberal interpretation of the waiver, in large part because the state and the court failed to bring him to trial within 90 days of the July 8th deadline.
But they did bring him into trial within 90 days of the period between May 14th and July 8th, and the period, the portion of the 90 days that was left after his new trial date, didn't they?
No, they didn't. Okay. They didn't even bring him to trial until more than 90 days had passed from the July 8th request for a continuance.
That wasn't my question.
Right.
The trial court concluded, and you don't disagree on appeal, that the 90 days first starts to run in May, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so we've got a portion of the 90 days between the May date and July 8th, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Then we've got a portion that's not, doesn't come out of the 90 days from July 8th to when his trial was rescheduled in late October, correct?
One more time, please.
Okay.
As far as between July,
between July 8th and late October, mm-hmm. when the trial was reset, that's chargeable to him because he asked for the continuance, right?
I disagree.
Why?
Under the general speedy trial rule, when you ask for a continuance, the six-month clock starts over again from the date you asked for a continuance. Here, he asked for a continuance on July 8th. I'm arguing that the 90-day deadline then starts over again from the date he asked for the continuance.
Is that consistent with the plain language of 104.1?
In my opinion, it gives the benefit of the doubt to the state. Personally, I believe that they had to bring him to trial within the remaining time of the 90 days. But in light of the facts of this case, They did not even bring him to trial within 90 days of the July 8th date. And the July 8th date, in my argument, reset the clock. And so they had to bring him to trial, not within any reasonable period of time they felt necessary, but within 90 days of the date he waived the UMDDA 90-day limit.
Is there any authority supporting your argument other than analogy to speedy trial? I.e. the reset the clock part of your argument.
There is not a great deal of case law definition one way or the other. I do believe I cited a couple of cases where they basically started the clock over again from the date of the request for the continuance. But the key provision of the UMDDA is that it is to bring people who are on parole or in prison to trial as quickly as possible so that they can continue in their rehabilitative therapy. If we were to hold that once you continue your UMDDA rights, then you can be brought to trial at any point in the future, open-ended, that defeats the primary purpose of the UMDDA. And so it seems that the only logical assumption is to treat the waiver of the 90 days as restarting the clock for an additional 90 days.
Ms. Jaffe?
Yes.
I'm looking at People v. Fleming, which I believe you cited in your brief, as did your opponent, and the justice says, if a continuance is granted for good cause, the 90-day period is effectively tolled for the length of the continuance. In other words, Fleming suggests that whatever that time is just extracted or deducted from the 90 days. How would that affect, if that's true, how would that affect your argument?
Based on that reading of Fleming, I would have to agree with Judge Webb, but it seems to me that Fleming is in error, because Fleming goes against the primary provisions of the UMDDA and the statute that specifically describes the time. I'm almost at 3 minutes, so I'd like to reserve the rest, but the statute specifically is intended to bring someone to trial as quickly as possible. If by requesting a continuance, a defendant is waiving completely any time limit, theoretically he could be brought to trial within a year or 2 years after the UMDDA, which defeats the purpose of the UMDDA. And if I may reserve the rest of my time, thank you.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is Paul Kaler. My registration number is 19210. And our argument has two parts. First of all, at the July 8th hearing, we believe that the waiver there and the advisement was adequate for the purposes of Carr. Secondly, we don't believe that Carr is correctly decided because it ignores the continuance components in subsection 1 of the statute. In subsection 1, 1614.104.1, it says, within such additional time as the court for good cause shall an open court may grant. Also, the parties may stipulate for a continuance. And thirdly, a continuance may be granted on notice to the prisoner's attorney and the opportunity to be heard. So it's not entirely the defendant's call whether he can go to the trial court and extend the time period for good cause shown. In this particular case, we think first time in the new courtroom, the July 8th proceedings are the most important ones. There we had the discussion of the UMDDA claim, specifically on the record. The defendant requests a continuance to address his conflict of counsel claim, which dragged on the proceedings even further. And also later on, the defendant formally waived bringing himself to trial until January 8th. The trial actually began in mid-November preceding that. So I think the trial began well within time. Also after that, the final ruling on the UMDDA claim, or the first one, was resolved on September 13th. Between then and the time of trial, the defendant was requested and was given two more continuances in order to be ready for trial. So I think, as both Judge Gilman found at trial and then Justice Quinn later at the 35C found, there were proper waivers here. The defendant, it was extended the time. And I think, coming down to it, I think the main problem with Carr is that UMDDA rights are important, but it has to become the defendant's focus of his actions thereafter. If the defendant wants other things done before the trial, then those things get charged to the defendant and the time period gets extended. And here the trial court was working hard to get this trial going. As soon as Judge Gilman found out that the defendant was talking about his UMDDA rights, she set a trial date almost immediately. The first trial that date was offered was for June 24, which was within 5 weeks of her learning about the situation, and defense counsel couldn't get going on that. So trial court was aware of the UMDDA. She tried working with the defendant and his counsel, trying to get everything done and in as timely a manner as possible, but the defendant wanted other things done before he went to trial. And then he explicitly told the trial court and the prosecution that he was fine with being tried before January 8th, and clearly that was done here. I don't have anything else to say. If the court has any concerns, I would like to try and address them. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Your Honors. When we go back to the issue of the UMDDA request for speedy or reset the trial, request to for a continuance, the key language that I think the court needs to look at is 1614-104-2. And that is, and this is what did not happen on July 8th, the defendant must and can only waive his UMDDA rights if he expressly waives UMDDA rights, which never occurred.
So why do we need to analyze this in terms of a waiver if he was brought to trial within 90 days of the original demand, less the period of time accounted for by the continuance that he requested?
Because he also has to be fully advised by the courts as to the consequences of his waiver.
Well, and but you keep coming back to waiver. Does he have to, is that advisement required if his attorney asks for a continuance for his benefit?
I believe so. I believe the language under subsection 2 is mandatory. The court has an affirmative duty to provide a full advisement to the defendant of the consequences of his action. At no point did the court ever tell Mr. Peoples that by requesting a continuance, the clock stops ticking on his speedy trial rights and he can be set for a new trial at any point in the future. The court never gave him the express waiver, so he had no reason to understand that by agreeing to a continuance or requesting a continuance, the court could set him out 3 months and 2 weeks, or 6 months. And thus, the court failed in its affirmative duty. And again, the duty is both on the court and the prosecutor to make sure that the defendant understands the consequences of his actions. And in this case, the court and the prosecutor, assuming your theory is correct, even then, the court had an affirmative duty by statute. And remember, the statute had been changed to include this affirmative duty. The court did not meet its affirmative duty to tell my client that he had, by waiving speedy trial, they could bring him to trial 3 weeks, 3 months, or longer. Thank you, Your Honor.
We appreciate